Welcome to Making Waves, independent voices for peace and justice. Your local connection to the world on WSCA LP 106.1 FM, Portsmouth Community Radio. This is Amy Antonucci, and I'm happy to introduce our show to you today, September 2nd, 2006. Our focus today is on New Orleans, a year after Hurricane Katrina. Here's what we have coming up. After the news, we'll bring you coverage of last Saturday's Bush protest in Kennebunkport, Maine. Then, for an interview with Nancy Brown of Portsmouth, New Hampshire, about her recent trip to New Orleans to help with the continuing cleanup. We'll also hear from Michael Parenti about New Orleans and the free market. In our second hour, we'll have Jav Parrish about the upcoming elections and Steve Diamond with No Plan for Iraq. We'll end with Between the Lines, independent radio out of Bridgeport, Connecticut. This week, Between the Lines brings us more about the current situation in New Orleans, plus reports on U.S. peace activists meeting with Iraqi parliamentarians, and a look at the recent FDA approval of the over-the-counter sale of the morning-after pill. We'll also have music, announcements, and more, so stay with us. First, for some news.
This is Steve Diamond with News You Need to Know. From the Washington Post, the United States has expanded its force in Iraq to 140,000 troops, the Pentagon said on Thursday, amid relentless violence in Baghdad and elsewhere. This follows July's decision by commanders to augment the U.S. military presence in Baghdad to try to curb the escalating sectarian violence that has heightened concern about an all-out civil war in Iraq. As American troops continue to fight a tenacious insurgency nearly 3.5 years into the war, U.S. military deaths in Iraq reached at least 64 in August, increasing from 43 in July. And from the Associated Press, the nation's governors sought help Thursday from Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld in their ongoing fight against proposals in Congress to give President Bush more control over the National Guard during disasters. All 50 governors signed a formal letter opposing a House provision in the National Defense Authorization Act that would let Bush federalize the Guard without governor's consent in the event of a, quote, serious natural or man-made disaster, accident, or catastrophe. A letter from the governors of Arizona, Minnesota, North Carolina, and South Carolina stated, "Each of these proposals represent a dramatic expansion of federal authority during natural disasters that could cause confusion in the command and control of the National Guard and interfere with states' ability to respond to natural disasters within their borders. Under current law, governors are commanders of the Guard in their states, and the president must get their consent to federalize the troops domestically, except in cases of rebellion." And from the British Independent, at least 100 people were killed across Iraq in one day of intense gun battles and suicide bombings, contradicting U.S. military claims that the security situation in the war-torn nation was improving. A total of 34 bodies, including 7 civilians and 25 Iraqi government soldiers, were brought into the central hospital in the town of Diwaniya after fighting between government forces and gunmen of the Mahdi Army, a Shia militia loyal to the radical cleric Muqtada al-Sadr. 50 gunmen were also killed in the gunfight, according to the Iraqi Defense Ministry. More than 10,000 Iraqis have been killed in the past 4 months alone, a figure that would send shockwaves through the international community were it in any other part of the world. The U.S. military admitted that there had been a spike in violence in Baghdad, but insisted that things were improving since U.S.-led forces launched Operation Forward Together last month in an attempt to pacify the capital. Reports suggested that militiamen had driven government forces out of Diwaniya and had set up checkpoints in the suburbs. If the Mahdi army has pushed the government out of the Shia-dominated city, it will be a major snub to Mr. Maliki, who has promised to rid Iraq of militias. And from Yahoo News, Iraq on brink of civil war. The conflict in Iraq has all the makings of a civil war, according to a U.S. Defense Department report. The report said, "The security situation is currently at its most complex state since the initiation of Operation Iraq Freedom. In the past 3 months, the average number of weekly attacks increased 15% over the previous reporting period average, and Iraqi casualties increased by 51% compared to the previous quarter." And from sfgate.com, about 100 Iraqi Shiite soldiers refused to go to Baghdad to support the security crackdown there, marking the second time a block of Iraqi soldiers have balked at following their unit's assignment, a U.S. general said on Monday. U.S. Brigadier General Dana Pittard commander of the Iraqi Assistance Group, said the problems stem from the Iraqi army's regional divide because soldiers are recruited in their home area and expect to train and serve there. And from the Associated Press, Kurdistan President Masoud Barzani has ordered the Iraqi national flag to be replaced with the Kurdish one in his northern autonomous region in what appeared to be another move toward more self-rule in the north, local officials said. And from Haaretz, United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan said on Tuesday that Israel was responsible for most of the violations of the UN-brokered ceasefire that ended the 34-day conflict between Israel and Hezbollah 2 weeks ago. Annan said, "We need to resolve the issue of the abducted soldiers very quickly. We need to deal with the lifting of the embargo, sea, land, and air, which for the Lebanese is a humiliation and an infringement on their sovereignty." The UN chief has said there is a high risk of renewed hostilities unless the resolution is fully implemented. And from Reuters, clearing unexploded cluster bombs used by Israel in Lebanon during the month-long war, many of them U.S. manufactured, could take 10 years, a British-based demining group said on Friday. Simon Conway, director of Landmine Action, said, "We will be clearing unexploded cluster munitions from the rubble of the villages of southern Lebanon for another decade." Before the recent war between Israel and Hezbollah guerrillas in the south, demining teams were still clearing unexploded cluster munitions from Israel's 1978 and 1982 incursions into Lebanon, according to the advocacy group which is campaigning for an international ban on their use. "Such weapons continue to kill and maim civilians, especially children, for years after the conflict," it said. The United Nations estimates that 100,000 cluster bomblets that failed to explode lie in Lebanon, with most landing during the final 72 hours of the war. UN Emergency Relief Coordinator Jan Egeland has called Israel completely immoral for using them in residential areas. Three types of artillery-delivered cluster bombs were used by Israel in Lebanon, two U.S.-made and one Israeli, each with roughly the same failure rate of 40%. And from the British Telegraph, the United Nations peacekeeping force to be deployed in Lebanon will not be allowed to intercept shipments of arms to Hezbollah from Syria. Speaking in Brussels before heading to the region, Kofi Annan, the UN Secretary General, confirmed that the 15,000-strong force will not meet Israeli demands to police the routes allegedly used by the militia to smuggle missiles from Syria. Annan said, "Troops are not going in there to disarm, let's be clear. The UNIFIL force will only carry out interception missions if asked to by the Lebanese government." Syria, meanwhile, accused by Israel of rearming Hezbollah during the recent conflict, has said the deployment of any UN forces near its border would be considered a hostile act. And from Agence France-Presse, UN nuclear inspectors have found no concrete proof that Iran's nuclear program is of a military nature, a senior official close to the UN nuclear agency said on Thursday. And finally, from MSNBC and the Associated Press, President Bush on Thursday predicted victory in the war on terror at a time of increasing public anxiety at home, likening the struggle against Islamic fundamentalism with the fight against Nazis and communists. With just over 2 months until Election Day, Bush said opponents of the war in Iraq who are calling for a plan to bring home troops would create a disaster in the Middle East. The president chose a friendly audience in one of America's most conservative states to begin his pre-election series of speeches defending his war strategy. Only a third of Americans say they approve of Bush's handling of the war or his leadership overall. The three-week campaign is tied to the fifth anniversary of the September 11th terror attacks. Bush described the current violence in the Middle East and the recently thwarted attacks to blow up planes over the Atlantic Ocean as part of the same movement that resulted in the September 11th attacks. Even in Utah, which gave Bush a wider margin of victory than any other state in the 2004 election, the president's appearance was a source of dispute. Salt Lake City Mayor Rocky Anderson led thousands of anti-Bush demonstrators on a march through the city Wednesday. He called Bush a, quote, "dishonest, warmongering, human rights-violating president." This is the third time in less than a year that Bush has made a series of speeches on Iraq and terrorism. This time, it's an all-hands-on-deck effort, with Vice President Dick Cheney, Rice, and Rumsfeld also touting the mission this week. That's all for the news for this week. Last Saturday, I covered an anti-war protest in Kennebunkport against George Bush and the ongoing war in Iraq. Here are some sounds from that event and the voices of the protesters there.
War in Iraq tomorrow. But as long as our communities are addicted to the military production process, as long as weapons are our number one industrial export of our nation, we will never end war. And so we must call for the conversion of the military-industrial complex. With your tax dollars, we should be building the world's best mass transportation system. We should be building solar so that we can put solar on every house and business in America. We should be building windmills. Imagine the jobs that could be created if we used your tax dollars to convert the military-industrial complex. Now, as we're walking, I'm told that Kennebunkport is a highly Republican conservative community. I don't know if that's true or not.
This war
does not make us safer.
This war
does not make us safer. This war.
So how did you first get involved in peace work?
Well, I don't know if you could call it getting involved in peace work. I just don't agree with this president's policies. Uh-huh. And haven't, and probably the first, well, this is my first march ever, peace march. Yeah. I'm new at this, actually. Okay. So it's been going on for a while as far as how I think about this regime. I'd call them a regime. Uh-huh. You know, they're not an administration, they're something else. So
you've been looking at the issue for a while, and what finally put you over the edge to want to voice your concerns in the street?
Been talking about it too long not to come out and do it, you know. Had to put my money where my mouth was.
So what issues concern you most about what George Bush is doing?
Oh, well, it's the Iraq war, obviously. He has no empathy for anybody who isn't in his price range, you know, basically. And he's killed hundreds of thousands of innocent people. He and Dick Cheney.
You mean the people in Iraq?
Absolutely. Yeah. Not our troops. Yeah, not to mention our troops and all the poor guys who have been damaged beyond belief for the rest of their lives. Just because of a war for profit, period. But I'm just afraid that they're going to start a war in Iran before it's over with.
Yeah, indeed. Would you care to give your name?
Yeah, Rick McLennan.
Nice to meet you, Rick. Thanks for talking to us. Hello?
Hello.
My name is Steve Diamond with Making Waves at WSCA in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. What do you think about the march here today?
I think it's really good and peaceful, and I'm here with a lot of my coworkers from the Unitarian Universalist Church Camping Conference Center.
Is it really about terrorism or is it about securing Middle Eastern oil?
Peace! Now! Peace! Now!
So how is change going to come about of reducing military spending and making the world a more peaceful place?
I think that's a good start, is just observing how much money goes into educating people how to kill one another and noticing how little money goes into educating people for peace. Mm-hmm. And if it's going to be long-term change, probably got to start educating for peace. Might have the Department for Peace, sounds like an interesting idea, or the U.S. Institute for Peace, maybe making that into a larger government body. I mean, our government's structured on a military hierarchy. It's pretty patriarchal to boot, and those things could be changed, and perhaps for the better. I think there are a lot of people who are intimidated by peace. There are a lot of people who currently have wealth and who continue generating wealth in this context. Mm. And they're in positions of power. And so that kind of change will be difficult to bring about.
Mm.
is what democracy looks like. This is what democracy looks like.
You know, I read the Nation magazine, as you may too, and they talk about media conglomeration, and it's like seven big giant companies that are doing all the news making, you know, producing the news that most people are getting. And those seven companies are all have vested interests in the military industrial complex, so they're telling the stories through the lens of corporations that are making a lot of money off the status quo and off the weapons productions and things like that. And if radio stations like Clear Channel stations and things like that just do that, then that's all people get a chance to hear, you know? If we lose independent media voice, you know, we're gonna lose our democracy, because people will be easily shepherded into the mindset that the corporations want us to be herded into. But I mean, obviously Fox, I think mainstream media is now advocacy journalism, because they're hooked up with, you know, like a General Electric and NBC, who have corporate interests in weapons producers, and, you know, own companies that make bombs and planes, and they certainly have a vested interest in selling those planes and bombs, you know. So that's advocacy journalism too.
Do you remember when on NPR and all these other stations they were talking about the Iraqi resistance, and all of a sudden they stopped? They started calling them the insurgency.
Right. See, those are the kinds of little nuances that you know, and that's even mild compared to some of the other. I mean, they're so quick to cause Hezbollah, a terrorist organization. I mean, you know, my view is one man's resistance fighter is another, one person's resistance fighter is another man's terrorist.
That's a mild Reagan quote, actually.
Is that what he? Yeah. And I mean, right. Even Ronald knew that. Where did the knowledge go that even Ronald, the great conservative, you know, had? It's like that truth is long gone, right? Now everybody's a terror. Anybody that doesn't, you know, knuckle under to George and Dick are considered terrorists. I mean, the big issue now is I think Bush is trying to, Bush and Cheney, are trying to prepare the, you know, to soften the country for a strike on Iran. And I think that would be a complete fiasco. It would be the beginning of a terrible, I mean, worse than it is now. And all of this stuff is really about making it clear to Bush and his supporters that the American public won't tolerate it. Yeah, that's the truth. Nice talking with you, Charles. Good luck.
Pardon me. Yep. My name is Steve Diamond. I'm Making Waves in Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Yep. Can we walk and talk?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And what's your name?
Bruce Gagnon.
How many people do you think were here today?
600. We counted them.
Yeah, we're thrilled with it. We think it was good.
Mm-hmm. Right. There were also many passers-by who stopped to observe the march, roughly half of whom supported the war on George Bush and half who didn't. Here's a representative sample of the people I spoke to. Hi there. What do you think about George Bush's job performance?
I'm sorry?
What do you think about George Bush's...
Talking to the wrong guy. I served in the war. I went to West Point. I pay my tax dollars, and I don't really feel like paying tax dollars to support this nonsensical piece of So you can do what you want with this information.
Hi there. You seem to have something to say. My name is Steve Diamond with Making Waves on WSCA in Portsmouth.
The best show out I've seen in a long time. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
How many would you guess, you think?
Out of 500? 5, 6?
The more the merrier. We've got a whole bunch here, too. We just can't leave our booths.
Oh, you're working here?
Yeah, we're all working here.
We're the working stiffs. We'd rather be marching.
All right. What do you guys think about George Bush's job performance?
I don't know. On a scale of 0 to 10?
Yes.
Minus 0.
And what gives
Very
him that... What disappoints you the most about his performance?
The proliferation of the war.
Yeah.
It seems like it's all about war.
The power structure of the administration.
Well, there was something last night on television, the McNeil Air Report, and one of the fellows said it's about delusion and deception. I thought that really...
Delusion, deception, arrogance.
Yeah, that really capped it. That really
and control.
I don't want him to represent me.
Big
he
time.
Doesn't represent
Big
me.
Big time. Very sad.
What do you think it'll take to stop the war?
It's going to be very hard to stop that war.
You ought to learn from the British. They tried it, 70 years ago? They had no luck at all.
or the French in Lebanon, et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera, et cetera. No, it's very difficult.
I will tell of this in Germany.
All right, thanks a lot. Hi there. My name is Steve Diamond of Making Waves in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. What do you think about the march here today?
I'm a pro-Bush man, so I'm not in favor of this. I'm all in favor of people expressing their views, so it's great to have people expressing their views, but I happen to believe that President Bush is doing the right thing.
He's doing the right thing in what way? What policies are you supporting of his?
In the war against terrorism. I think it's, it's a very tough thing. He hates the carnage. I know him well. I happen to be related to him. Hates the carnage. And he interviewed some people yesterday who were families have been killed, and he was in tears as he talked to them. And I know it absolutely destroys troubles him. So I respect people who have a different view, and he does too. But I'm not going to join this demonstration because I'm on the other side.
Okay, I appreciate that. George Bush has recently stopped talking about progress and started talking about how much worse it would be if we were to leave. What gives you hope that we're succeeding in Iraq?
Well, I think talking to some people who have been there, and we do have a number of friends who went over. A very good friend of mine has just gone over to be head of USAID there. And there are new hospitals being built. There are more people going to school there. We do have that absolutely terrorist man, Saddam Hussein, who's going to be, who at one point did have weapons of mass destruction, being tried and perhaps executed in the next 6 months. So that is progress. But nevertheless, there are some very discouraging things, and we know that. We know that. And it bothers us that the terrorists are being funded by the Iran, and that is a tough thing. And some of that, obviously, is coming from the oil that we're buying. The money that's going to Iran is from the gas and oil that all of us buy. You too, sir, and me. And that, so in a way, we're funding some terrorists who are out to destroy us.
And not just Iran. Most of the 9/11 terrorists were from Saudi Arabia.
Exactly. Egypt. And Syria, obviously, is not being helpful in this whole process. So it's a very tough situation. Very tough. So I respect what is going on up here because there are people with strongly felt views, but I think President Bush has strongly felt, deeply deep views and a lot of conviction, and he has some very wise people around him who we know. We have great respect for the Secretary of State, Secretary Rice, a terrific person, and many others who are in his circle. So I appreciate your asking my opinion, and thank you. And
good. Can I ask you one more question?
Sure, yes.
How do you think America might be able to wean itself off of oil so that we aren't supporting all these...
Of course, that's a very difficult question, and I guess it would require further tax on gas, but perhaps the best answer to that is developing more alternate energy, other sources that will replace gas and oil. And I know... The government is working hard on that, plus many, many companies in America. But that's a tough one, and I wish it could happen much sooner than it is happening. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, sir.
What do you think about George Bush's job performance?
I think it's dreadful. I'm all for these people that say, let's impeach him.
All right.
But don't quote me. As long as you don't have my name, I guess it's all right.
Okay, thanks. Bravo, Bush! Hi there. What do you like so much about Bush?
I think he's a very strong president. I think his foreign policy thinking is wide, big. Touch of Wilsonian and a touch of Harry Truman.
Is it working?
Can't get two better ones than that. Bravo, Bush! Bravo, Bush!
How you doing?
Hey, pretty good.
This is wonderful. Yeah.
This is the best thing going. I'm so glad this is happening.
All right.
I didn't think that they were going to pull it off like this, and I'm glad they are.
Ah, great.
I hope he comes to his senses. I don't know if they, I don't know if that's possible at all. But.
Maybe born again after for a while.
Maybe, yeah.
So this is maybe a silly question at this point, but what do you think about George Bush's job performance exactly?
I think it's probably the poorest performance I've ever seen of any president, and I don't think that anybody can go as low as he has, truthfully.
If you could change one policy of his, what would you change?
His addiction to war, basically. Maybe it's not a policy, but that's what bothers me the most. He seems a war addict.
And he's never been there himself. He was defending us from Mexico during Vietnam.
Exactly. Yep.
Thanks a lot.
Interesting.
Hi there, folks. What do you like so much about President Bush?
Take a hike.
Hello?
Hi.
I'm Steve Diamond with Making Waves on WSCA.
Hi, Steve.
What do you think about George Bush's job performance?
I don't think he's done a very good job. I think he's made a lot of mistakes, and I think he's let his ego get in the way of his decisions.
What decisions in particular do you find most troubling?
The war is the biggest.
What do you think about the march here today?
I've never seen such a turnout in this town as this one, and I've seen protests before. This is the largest one I've ever seen. I think it's nice that people care that much.
Do you live here in town?
This is my store.
Hi there.
Hi.
What do you think of George Bush's job performance?
Fantastic.
What do you like about it?
Everything.
Okay. What do you think of the march today?
Their rights. I say they have their rights.
Uh-huh.
I have mine.
Okay.
I'm against what they're doing.
But you support their right to say it?
Absolutely.
Okay. Hi there, folks. My name is Steve Diamond with Making Waves and WSCA in Portsmouth. What do you guys think about the march here today?
Well, you know, they have their right, you know, but, you know, I'm not going to join in. I mean, I believe, you know, what they're saying, but, you know, I'm not going to join in.
What do you think about the war that's going on in Iraq?
Well, I believe our guys should be home. You know, I think we had enough, you know, too much killing and stuff. It's just too much.
Hello?
How you doing, sir?
Pretty good. What do you think of George Bush's job performance?
I'm for President Bush, to be honest with you. Okay, I work for the United States Military Academy in West Point. My son's been over in Iraq for two tours now. When my son says we need to be over there, we need to be over there. It keeps everything away from us here in the country. These people need to get a second grip on life. I'm not for war as a total, but there's a terror out there, and we need to get it before it comes into our turf.
So it's the fight them there so we don't have to fight them over here idea.
You gotta stop them. You gotta stop them before they actually do what they did again on 9/11.
But in Iraq, they're not the ones who did 9/11, as Bush has said. Why are we in Iraq exactly?
We turn around, we have to go ahead and do what we have to do. The terrorism was from over there. It started over there. It's still in this country, and we gotta go ahead and be on alert at all times. I'm not saying that Bush has done everything politically correct, but show me a president that has.
Well, thanks for your help. Hi there. What do you think of George Bush's job performance?
Hate him.
Are you here with the marchers, or just happen to be in
there? Oh, we just happen to be going around.
Just here, yeah.
What do you think about the marchers here today?
It's great.
Yeah, I think it's really great. It's nice to see a peaceful protest, too. You know, it was really well-run and
a lot of people. It's good. I said, nice, yeah. We knew he was going to be here, which we could care less about. Then we saw that, we were like, good. Yes,
plus it's nice to see all different age ranges and, you know, all different types marching.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Hey there, folks.
Hey, how are you?
Pretty good.
Nice.
My name is Steve Diamond with Making Waves out of Portsmouth, New Hampshire.
Nice.
How would you guys evaluate Bush's job performance?
Awful. I don't know if it's much of a performance at all.
It's a bit of a show.
Yeah, I guess. Yeah, he's pretty... I would say the supporting cast is probably what's impressive in the situation at hand.
Karl Rove and the whole bunch there?
Yeah.
What's been so awful about his... What particular policies have you disapproved of the most?
I mean, pretty much everything across the board. Education, the war, welfare, stuff for poor people in general. Pretty much his hatred towards all people except rich white people is what really bothers me.
Wow. Are you guys from right around here?
Yes.
Yep.
Oh. Raised.
What do you think about the march here today?
It's awesome. It's good getting people out, showing our disapproval for a guy that claims not to be a resident even though he lives year round, so he doesn't have to support the school system with his taxes and whatnot, but that's another issue.
Do you guys have any stories about what sort of impact he has on the town or what you've seen of him around?
Back before he found Jesus, he was a lot more entertaining in the bar scene, but
that's true.
Now he's kind of lame soup, and you know, back when
your mom's previous husband
knocked him out. It's true, right at the breakwater up the road. What else?
Knocked him out?
Punched him in the face. Yeah.
Well, thanks for good talking with you. Hi there. What do you guys think about George Bush's job performance?
I don't know enough.
I feel like I don't know enough about the truth, what's really going on, and I also feel that my gut feeling is that that there's something wrong.
What do you think about the march here today?
I think it's important that people vent what they're feeling, no matter what it is, wrong or right. So I think it's a good thing.
Thank you very much.
I could
say that I feel the United States is creating more tension than it's ameliorating in the world. It's just taking that edge. So it's very scary for me personally.
Thank you both very much.
Thanks. Yeah.
Tune in later on this month for audio from speeches at the rally after the Kennebunkport March.
Thanks to Steve Diamond for that coverage of last weekend's protest. Now we move to exploring New Orleans a year after Katrina.
This is Amy Antonucci with Making Waves. This past week, the one-year anniversary of the tragedy of Hurricane Katrina hitting New Orleans and the surrounding area passed. With that in mind, we're talking today with Nancy Brown. She is a longtime Portsmouth resident. She's been a teacher for 25 years, a parent, a grandparent, and an activist. And she spent the first part of her summer vacation in New Orleans doing work to clean elementary schools so that people can return to those buildings. She went there with 68 members of the Phillips Exeter Academy community, which is where she teaches. And an article that she wrote about her experience appeared in the Portsmouth Herald in late July. It was entitled The Mold of Poverty. Welcome to the show, Nancy.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here to share some of my experiences.
Let's start by hearing about your trip. When you went, what you were involved in, who you were working with.
I actually tried to volunteer to go with the group of people over Christmas break, and made almost a half a dozen different connections with different groups, making different phone calls, and nothing seemed to work. I found out that you had to be with an organized group. Like there was a Red Cross group in some area in the Gulfport, and they said to me, oh, if you organize a group of 25 people, we'll be glad to take you. So I thought, oh, I guess I'm going to have to put this off. And then our director of alumni services, Harold Brown, he's actually director of alumni affairs at Exeter Academy. He visited New Orleans Ninth Ward in February 2006, and he decided that he would put together a service trip, which, as you just said, mentioned a moment ago, would involve members, you know, a variety of members of the school community. So there were staff members, some faculty, including myself, and parents and students. It was absolutely wonderful to work alongside of some of the students that I actually had in the classroom. Harold Brown organized this, and we went into and worked in an area that was called the Carleton United Neighborhood Organization in a predominantly African-American community that had been somewhat devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And our task was to work in several schools. Like the one school we worked in, the school had been sealed for 10 months. If you can imagine an elementary school being sealed for 10 months. Mm-hmm. So it was opened up, not by us, but by a group of college students who were there also working, doing volunteer work. And then we were in and out of the school for like 2 days, basically, going in, carrying all the books and desks and computers and files and shelves and everything out of the first floor, because it had, you know, there was like 4 feet of water in that first floor. And it was just incredible. Oh, the smells, the mold, the devastation to watch all these children's books and supplies have to be tossed out. So we'd carry all these things out and line it up along the streets. And then we did this in two other schools, similar work, but not exactly like this particular elementary school. And then a decontamination company was going to come in and scrub everything down. So the students, I'm assuming, the students are back in school in that particular school at this moment in time.
How long were you there working on this?
We were there for a week. You know, it seems like a pretty short time, but it was pretty exhausting work. So we would get up as a group, and we were staying initially, we thought we were going to be staying with families. I can't imagine how we would have stayed with families, because most of the families that were there or had returned, things were still pretty difficult for them. So we were put in a couple of different hotels, somewhere around the Bourbon Street, French Quarters, and then we'd meet at 7 o'clock every morning, get on a school bus, and be taken to this Carleton neighborhood, meet in like a Baptist church community center, and then divide up the work areas and tasks, and then work in teams. It was a week's worth of work, but by the end of that week, everybody was pretty wiped out. Although we all said if we had 1 or 2 days of rest, we would certainly have stayed another week.
How much of the city did you get to see? Did you get a sense for how the reconstruction is going and how much devastation still remains?
They gave us 2 days, two different times. We took buses that were taking us to work. We went around different areas. Like, they took us to the Ninth Ward and showed us many different areas in and around New Orleans. So I felt we got amazing exposure and had good sense of how things were. Of course, we didn't see how things were 10 months ago, but looking at it in June 2006, there was still so much to be done. And I believe a little less than half of the number of people who live in New Orleans have returned, and about maybe a third of the children that normally would have been there to go to these particular public schools, they've returned. So what we saw was, it was total silence, those of us all sitting in the bus when we'd ride in and out of these areas and see the devastation, you know, roofs and houses completely collapsed or whole sides of houses off. Once or twice they let us get out of the bus and you could walk down some of the streets that were totally abandoned in these neighborhoods. The neighborhoods were abandoned. You could walk up to the houses and look through the windows, or a whole side of the house was completely broken off, so you could look into the house. And everything, you know, was piled up on top of each other and moldy, and the smells were really... I can't imagine what people have gone through at the time, let alone what they're still going through, those who are not able to have returned to their homes. So we got to see quite a bit. Those were abandoned. And then there were some areas where, especially in the schools we were working in, where there were people in the neighborhoods. Several of us walked around in between little breaks from working in the schools, which is what I wanted to do, to talk to people who were there, and had some interesting conversations with people who had experienced this terrible disaster.
In the article that you wrote, Nancy, you spoke about your time 4 decades ago in the 60s working as a VISTA volunteer in eastern Kentucky, which was part of the effort to end poverty, the war on poverty. And you wrote that you felt a lot of parallels and you saw a lot of the same things. Tell us about that. Tell us about the similarities. Tell us about the connections you made between these two trips.
That was a very interesting thing that happened to me. I'm working in and out of these schools and then having these conversations with some of the local people in the poor neighborhoods. There was at one point when we were emptying things out of the schools, I thought, this is so incredible. This is just such a disaster. I can't imagine that any of us would have our children go back into these schools, even though these schools are eventually going to be decontaminated and repaired, because I don't know how can you decontaminate a school that's been sealed shut, the smells and the mold and potentially how unhealthy it was. Anyway, all these things were going through my mind. And then I started thinking about, oh, wow, the sense of hopelessness that I saw on people's faces reminded me of some of the things I remember experiencing for the first time in my life when I was in Baltimore, Maryland in the late 60s being trained to work in the War on Poverty program. And then I was sent to West Virginia and then Kentucky. It was the first time I had ever seen poverty and despair to that extent. Not that I was naive, but I had no idea that people were so poor in this country. So I remember being taken into people's homes in Baltimore, Maryland, like a family of six or seven or eight people living in two rooms in these really poor black neighborhoods in Baltimore, and talking with people and feeling like, oh my God, they have this sense of hopelessness. And that's the same kind of feeling I had when I was in New Orleans. So it brought back all these memories. And then I started thinking about there's this systemic poverty in this country, and what have we done? What about all those promises that were made, not just a year ago in New Orleans, but four decades ago? I remember in the late 60s, people really believed that change was coming. That we all need to work together, educate each other, hold our elected officials accountable. And I guess that none of that's really happened. Well, it's happened. There have been some changes, but we're under an illusion to think that the change that has been promised has really happened in this country. I see racial inequities and social injustice. It's here. It's alive. It's thriving. You know, we're talking about the schools in New Orleans. Before Katrina, New Orleans was poor. Most of us know that, with one of the poorest educational systems in our country. How do we end that? How do we end poverty and ignorance and racial and social injustice that I thought, ah, here it is. It's as clear as day. I'm here in New Orleans and I'm looking in these people's faces and I'm thinking, what do we do with this? Where do we go with this?
Do you have any answers to that?
How do you change a city that was in bad shape with poor schools, poor neighborhoods for decades? Well, it's going to take a lot of work. It's going to take a lot of money and work and belief in the fact that this can happen. So we need many things. And if we were to break that down, here's what I would say. We need meaningful reform. Okay? It's sort of what I wrote in my article to the Portsmouth Herald, that I believe people deserve better and that the promises that were made should be kept. We need to address this systemic poverty in our country and look at the fact that racism and inequality exists. It might be hidden a little more so than, you know, we're willing to admit, but it is certainly there. I think we need to have living wages, affordable health care, good housing for people. And I heard that they're not going to rebuild public housing in New Orleans. What does that mean for the poorest of the poor, that that's where they lived? So people have a right to quality housing, quality education. So the schools that are going to be reopened, and I believe half of those schools are being reopened this month in August, although only about, they said about a third of the students are back. But I understand that a majority of the schools are charter schools. We need to hold them accountable, you know, whether it's a public school or a charter school. And we need help for those people who are ill, especially for those elderly and handicapped people who suffered terribly so from Hurricane Katrina. We also need to look at global warming. That's a major issue. We're going to fix those levees. This is serious. We need to make some serious changes, and we need to help people understand the changing climate and where it's coming from. What's our connection to that? We want to prevent future disasters. And one of the things that I feel strongly about is I would like to engage in a dialogue with my elected officials, with my neighbors, with my students, and hold ourselves and our politicians accountable for things that I think are unjust and unequal, and kind of revive those promises. Or maybe we need to start over. You know, what do we really need as a nation so that we can help bring about social justice and equality?
Also in your article, you mentioned that some parts of New Orleans were taking a long time to rebuild, implying that other parts were not. What did you mean by that? What did you see as far as that inequity?
When they gave us a tour, they showed us the area like the Ninth Ward, which is the one area that they think possibly will not be rebuilt. Because if there is another natural disaster like that, that there's probably nothing that they're going to do to prevent that from happening again. And that's where the poorest of the poor were living, in the Ninth Ward. So there were areas that were completely untouched. French Quarters, anything based on the level people's houses were. The lowest lying areas are the most vulnerable ones. And the poorest areas are, in fact, you know, we're in the lowest lying areas.
So the more money a person had, the higher up they could buy as far as flood zones. So those who didn't have the money to have bought high up now have less.
Yes, yep. That inequality does exist. You know, we don't seem to talk enough about that. Or they said 50% of the people in New Orleans live below the poverty line, and that was before Katrina. And oftentimes that leads to what we're hearing in the news, somebody whose lives are that devastating, that leads to hopelessness and violence and some of the problems that we're continually hearing reports on the news, the increase in violence. And well, that's been there for a long time. All of these things have to be addressed.
Do you have any thoughts or reflections on the racial aspect of this tragedy? There's been a fair amount of talk that people of color were far more negatively impacted. What did you see when you were there that would shed some light on that issue?
Definitely. I mean, the racial discrimination, to me it was very clear that the neighborhoods that we went into that were impacted the most were African American. Definitely a connection between race and economic. I mean, that's part of racism. You know, that's part of the systemic poverty. I mean, not that it is just African Americans, but the higher percentage of people who live below that poverty line are African American. That's just not okay. That's part of the dialogue that we need to open up, and we need to be critical of, you know, our public school systems or any school system that, you know, as I said, one of the poorest educational systems in the country. Why is that so? You know, why is that predominantly in an African-American community? And how do we change that? What's our responsibility? And I think we all have a responsibility. They're our neighbors, no matter if they're across the street from where I live or if they're in New Orleans. It goes back to what I was saying, that we need some meaningful reform, and we need to hear the voices of the people who are the most disenfranchised and involve them in, you know, reconstructing their lives and their communities so that they can live healthy lives like many of us do here in Portsmouth.
It seems that while the efforts by the government to respond to and ameliorate this disaster have obviously fallen short, it's interesting how much people on a more individual level or small groups of volunteers, as you went, their work there continues, and people have really wanted to help. People have really responded in a very humane, human way to the problems of people that they identify with.
That was very heartfelt. Everywhere we went, there were representatives of different volunteer groups from all over the country. So we're sitting in a little restaurant, and there would be two people sitting across the way with a T-shirt on from church group in Ohio, or another group from Habitat for Humanity. Like I sat next to a young college student on the flight returning home from New Orleans, and he was just finishing his first or second year in college and said this was his second time having gone to New Orleans. And that was wonderful. That was a wonderful part of the experience, that so many people opened their hearts. And, of course, many people also their pocketbooks, because much was collected from citizens throughout the country to help. And it's a really diverse group of volunteers from all across the country. Some of them were in tents. I remember a person saying, oh, someone had set up like a campsite and they were all living in tents. And they'd get up in the morning and there was somebody who'd prepare their breakfast. And then they went off in groups of 7 or 8 and they worked in 25 different homes. So each group of 7 or 8 worked in somebody's home and they were cleaning out that home and decontaminating it and rebuilding or tearing down the part that needed to be torn down and rebuilt. And then they would go back to wherever they came from, whether it was in state Midwestern or on the East Coast or West Coast, whatever. And then another group on their church or their neighborhood group would then follow through with continuing the work. I thought, wow, how come we don't hear enough of those stories? Suppose if you get to the 15th page of some newspaper, you might see a story of what the average American citizen is doing. But, you know, I believe New Hampshire Habitat for Humanity has taken some groups down and will be doing that again. So if anyone's interested in doing this, I'm sure there are a number of either church groups or organizations, you know, civic-minded organizations that would welcome your interest in joining them.
It's interesting that we hear so much about the tendency for people to do bad things to each other. And we have so much expectation for violence and so much fear of each other. And actually, it sounds like what you saw most there was not people looting, in quotes, or hurting each other, but people helping and people having this deep desire that moved them to take time from their lives and get on a plane and fly to somewhere where it wasn't very pleasant to be because they felt so strongly that they wanted to help. That's quite beautiful, really.
Yeah, I agree. That part was really pretty wonderful to have worked with an incredible group of people and to see all these other people. I mean, so are the people in the neighborhood of the schools where we were cleaning out. I really had a sense that we were really all involved. And most of the, I guess, the planning or the reconstruction was originally started by citizens. Because it's taken a really long time for, whether it was FEMA, the federal government. So people desperately wanted to get back into their homes, and they started it themselves. And what a courageous efforts by the local people. But obviously they need help with infrastructure, and I guess the electric power companies, I mean, electricity's off a percentage of the time, and water is still contaminated in many places. There's so many problems. I can't begin to address all the things. Anyway, we must not turn away from it or deny that this is important for us to take a look at and have some lessons to learn from it. If this happens again, that perhaps it wouldn't be as devastating and that our response would be quicker and, you know, more heartfelt than it was. In many respects, in my mind, the fact that it's taken so long and so many people lost their homes and all their belongings, their way of life, is sort of a defeat for our nation that we haven't, in terms of our leadership, come to their aid much quicker, where so much of our effort and our money is going to the Mideast to support this, what I call, illegal, outrageous war that we started in Iraq. But just to go back to what I said, that we are certainly all involved in this and we have a great deal of work to do together. And a great deal to learn in talking with each other. What can we do to work together to resolve some of these incredible inequities and injustices?
I'd like to end by hearing about some of the work you're doing locally. I know that you are very involved in local activities around social change.
Well, I try and stay involved as much as I can in my local community. I certainly do support Seacoast Peace Response and all their efforts and programs that they do in the community. I've been working with a group on and off for a number of years called Lions for Democracy. We've done a series of public forums on different issues to help educate and inform people of critical issues that impact all of us. I am recently become chair of Ward 1 for the local Democratic Party, which is fun. It's a new group of people to work with. They're wonderful, and we're working on issues, you know, like getting people involved in the democratic process, voting, looking at the things that impact their lives, and trying to make change, positive change. Oh, something I'd like to mention, and maybe some, you know, our listeners have already seen this. Spike Lee just released a film, a documentary, a four-hour documentary called When the Levees Broke, and it was shown on HBO last week and also this week. I'm sure that it will eventually become available for us, those of us who do not have HBO, but it will become available for us to watch together with our family or members of our community, and perhaps it might be something that we could show on a community level. I mean, here's a way to like open up that dialogue, to look at that film and maybe invite some people to come in and talk about racial injustices and inequities and look at the many different perspectives and what can we do, you know, as citizens. So anyway, I encourage people to watch for that film, When the Levees Broke, and understand it shows many different perspectives, how poor and the disenfranchised were disproportionately affected. I believe it was quite controversial. Majority of those people who were disenfranchised were, in fact, African Americans. To me, right off, that's a way you cannot deny that racism is in our lives and that it exists and that we should not turn away from this but embrace it and look at what do we need to do, what needs to be done. So to sort of end that, I guess here's a year and a city that it's still without a plan, and so many people that are still homeless and without adequate homes or schools or healthcare systems or sanitation. Let's continue to press our elected officials and ourselves to make sure that what needs to be done gets done and that this doesn't happen again to this extent.
Nancy, thanks so much for talking with us today and telling us about your trip to New Orleans and the experiences that you had there and the thoughts and reflections on that experience.
Thank you, Amy.
Sweet New Orleans out.
but have no home. You've been left there in those waters, naked and alone, in the streams of poison blood. Now what you gonna do to hold back the flood? Now what you gonna do to hold?
That was Elin Jewell with The Flood.
To hear our previous shows, please visit our archive online at www.freewebs.com/sprav/audio.htm. Please email nhmakingwaves@yahoo.com and let us know what you think of our show. And feel free to call the station in the next hour for more information, 430-9722.